Many have asked, National Review, UC Faring Magazine, will you finally sail the Atlantic? Our answer, yes, emphatically. Join us August 31st to September 7th aboard Cunard Line's spectacular Queen Mary II on NR's 2017 Transatlantic Crossing. This affordable, once-in-a-lifetime experience on many a bucket list sails from England to New York. On board will be conservative stars including Tom Coburn, Michael Mukasey, Mark Halperin, Rich Lowry, Douglas Murray, Ricochet regulars like Rob, Jonah, Jay, James, Mad Dogs Charlie, and Kevin, and many more. You know you want to come, so do it. Visit nrcruise.com to get complete information or call 888-283-8965. And every Ricochet member who comes will get a $50 cabin credit. See you on board.
We have special news for you.
The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
Are you going to send me or anybody that I know to a camp?
We have people that are stupid.
Mr. President, I am surprised that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's the Ricochet Podcast with John Gabriel sitting in for Rob Long. Peter Robinson is here. I'm James Lilex, and we have John Yu to talk about law and David Limbaugh to talk about everything. Let's have ourselves a podcast. Welcome, everybody, to this, the Ricochet Podcast, number 340. How do we get this far? Well, with great sponsors, of course. We're brought to you by The Great Courses. We want you to discover The Great Courses Plus, and you can get a full free month when you sign up using our special URL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. And we're brought to you by The John Oliver Show. Today's episode is brought to you by the HBO Emmy-winning series Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. You can catch the season premiere Sunday, February 12th at 11 p.m., only on HBO. And we're brought to you by Wink. If you like good wine but you can't even spell sommelier, it's time to take the stress out of wine shopping and try Wink. It's the new way to get all the best wines perfectly matched to your palate. Go to trywink.com/ricochet. And, of course, we're brought to you by Ricochet.com. And the readers and the listeners are now on the edge of their seat wondering if Rob is going to come in and tell you why you should join, because that would mean Rob's back. But Rob's still out there doing that work thing that he insists is important to his life. Fine. But what Rob would say is a couple of things. One, first of all, he'd welcome all of the new listeners on Slate's Panoply Network, which I will do, just did. Second, Rob would say that you should join Ricochet because it's the home of center-right, smart, and civil conversation. We're more than halfway to our goal of 1,500 new members, and you can help us out. That's what he'd say, and so I just did on his behalf. Rob would also say, with that sigh, that a Ricochet gift certificate is the best gift you can give for the smart and civil person in your life. Yes, Christmas is over, but Valentine's Day is coming up, and what says love more than that? Here's a place you should go and type. I think that's what I'm getting my wife. And while you're ready, you might want to subscribe to The Daily Shot as well. It's Ricochet's free daily email newsletter, and it's a great way to keep tabs on current events and see what's going on the center-right side of the world. If you're on the center-left, on the left, on the progressive, on the anarcho-syndicalist, whatever, if nothing else, you can see what the other side is arguing and thinking about. And just for that reason alone, you should get The Daily Shot. If not, at least you get a couple of laughs out of it. There, that's all of that behind us now. Join Ricochet, please. And you give these guys something to do. We've got John Gabriel and Peter Robinson. John, hello. Peter, hello.
Hello, hello.
Well, what a week it's been, eh? I have the feeling we'll be saying that in perpetuity. It's the sort of week that started out with tuberculosis for Peter, right? Are you getting better now? Is that it?
No, I am getting better. I'm on antibiotics and a thing that you inhale. And but yes, the answer is yes. In fact, I'm at that stage. This is an annoying thing. It's an annoying thing to experience, but it's an annoying thing to have people say, but I'm going to say it anyway. I actually feel better than I sound.
Oh, I understand.
So ignore the cough, the rasp. I'm fine.
Yeah, you get to the tertiary stage of a good cold, and that's what it is. So we had this week in which we began 3 or 4 days ago, I think. I can't even remember what we were arguing about and upset about, because he was eclipsed by a comment about destroying a senator's career, hardy har har, a joke, civil asset forfeiture, great thing, revelation that the president didn't know exactly what that was all about, thought it was about drugs only, and then boom, that was gone because Ivanka Gate and Nordstrom and the rest of it. And I look at all of this and I realize that every day I wake up with a certain set of assumptions. One, the press is going to hyperventilate about something that really doesn't matter in the end. Two, the president is going to do something that probably is salutary to the long-term health of the country in an appointment or an action. Three, the president is going to say something that indicates that his sense of decorum and presidential gravitas is non-existent, and we're wildly going all over the road like a seismograph needle, and it's terrifying for some. And four, there will be something in there that is completely, indeed, worrisome. What a mixed basket. John, what say you?
Well, I've been feeling the same way, and I think a lot of what we're seeing, especially on the left, and shockingly, I'd include the media in that, is on the conservative side, we saw this coming when Trump won the nomination. So we've kind of dealt with it. You know, some people grieved, some people cheered, but we've all dealt with it. But it seems like Democrats still don't really believe it's happening. So they're at stage one or two of the stages of grief. And they better get to acceptance quickly, or they're going to have heart issues. They need to calm down and also pick the fights that matter. They're investing so much, not only funding capital, but also just emotional capital on trying to oppose DeVos and Tom Price last night, and just going into these histrionics. All they're doing is demoralizing their base, because these were going to be fait accomplis pretty much. And you're going to have a new cabinet secretary approved probably 3 more next week, I would assume at least. So they should calm down. It's going to be a very difficult 4 years for them if they keep this up.
How can you calm down when we have a fascist administration that wants to destroy public education, that does not want children to be able to learn? It wants to keep them in this magnificent institution we have now so that they can thrive and prosper as they have been doing. You're right. There is a lot of hyperventilating. But if there's anybody – there are people who really thrive on being emotionally agitated all the time and constantly, perpetually aggrieved, because it proved that they're right. And they would hate not to be angry, because if you're not angry, you're not paying attention. They can keep it up, Peter?
Yes, I suppose they can keep it up. I haven't noticed any – we'll see. But I haven't noticed any fall off. I thought the New Yorker, the night of the election, David Remnick put up a piece in which he said effectively the country had gone off a cliff. It was a dark day. I think you kept talking about darkness, I think. In any event, I thought, well, all right, that everybody's allowed an emotional outburst, and it took them completely by surprise. The New Yorker, online particularly, the blog items. But in the – I just got the latest issue the other day, and this is the cover. It's an unbelievable cover. The cover shows the torch, the right arm of the Statue of Liberty holding the torch, mm-hmm. and the torch has gone out.
Yes.
And there's a wisp of smoke curling into the sky where the torch has gone out on the Statue of Liberty. And that's the cover on the New Yorker. Now, it's been since November 8th, since Donald Trump was elected, most of the rest of the country, or at least large segments of the country, are doing what we're doing, which is recalibrating from Donald Trump personal. I mean, it seems to me this much is clear. He surrounded himself with genuine conservatives and real grown-ups. The cabinet is, by and large, impressive, people of accomplishment, and by and large, quite conservative. Neil Gorsuch, no one seems to have any doubt that he's a constitutionalist and a serious jurist. Okay, so those are the people around him. And in Donald Trump himself, you've got impulses, which are patriotic and populist, mixed with conservative. More good impulses than ill, I think. And he's demonstrated a willingness to listen to these serious people who are around him. And then the final element is you also have a five-year-old child in the president himself. And that much, I think, is clear to the three of us, to most people who are paying attention and have been trying to sort it out, sort of have sorted it out now. And what this means is that a great deal that comes from the president himself, mostly by way of Twitter, is simply noise. It doesn't have policy implications. If you're in Washington and you make money, if you're at talk radio, I suppose we're a species of talk radio, but no, we're not. We're completely different. That's wrong of me even to suggest. But if you're in the business of moment by moment agitation, you have to pay attention to Donald Trump's tweets. The rest of the country can very safely just ignore them. And I think that most of the rest of us are just learning to listen. It's white noise. You get used to not listening to it. But the New York Times and the New Yorker and Elizabeth Warren, what I can't figure out is whether they are in good faith, stunned, struggling with disbelief, and foaming at the mouth through a kind of sense of righteousness and fury, or whether all of they're making calculated commercial and political decisions. So the New Yorker, it's a bit of both. Yeah, you see what I'm trying to say. Elizabeth Warren needs to keep that base agitated because she needs to have money come in. Chuck Schumer's got a problem. He needs to keep the base agitated to keep money coming in. On the other hand, he at the same time knows that's no way to rebuild the Democratic Party in Wisconsin or up the northern part of the Midwest. In any event, so it's a mixture. I guess it is a mixture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's an element of Rumpelstiltskinism on the Democratic side, pulling both your legs and just sundering yourself in a fit of pique, yes. Which the Republicans have done from time to time as well. But now we seem to be in this phase. I mean, since the election is still a couple of years out there, what's the harm of them right now in building up all this righteous anger? And that's what I think Warren is doing. I think it's probably genuine on her part, in as much as she believes herself to be the crusader and the right-thinking person who will save the lower classes from the depredations of the plutocrats. But then you look at Cory Booker, who would make an impassioned speech in one day about the need to improve our schools and find new choices and new opportunities, and then will turn around and vote against somebody because, as he knows, he's going to need those people for their money and their institutional backing when it comes to it. It's a curious hill for them to want to die on, because public education, while a lot of people have good feelings about it, we're not married to the idea that there's only one way it can possibly be accomplished.
You're making a point that seems to me worth dwelling on for just a moment, because it's absolutely critical. We have been told again and again and again through the campaign and since the election that Donald Trump is a demagogue, or at least he has the tendencies of a demagogue. Let me tell you about demagogues. Elizabeth Warren knows that Jeff Sessions is not a racist. Mm-hmm. And there she is saying things on the record, on the floor of the United States Senate, a letter from 1986 when people may genuinely have wondered about his record. 1986, 30 years ago, she knows better. Cory Booker knows that Jeff Sessions is not a racist. And yet there he sat testifying against the man. Anybody who spent any time at all looking at education in this country knows two things for sure. One, public schools in a lot of places, in many places, they're fine. But in many places, they are, particularly inner cities, they're failing the children they are meant to educate. Two, they don't get better because the teachers' unions make it impossible to make them better. Those two facts are known to anyone who spends any time studying public education. What follows from those facts, reasonable people may quite sensibly argue about whether you go to charter or voucher or whether you try to reform public schools themselves by weakening. But those two facts are known, and the Democrats have denied them and denied them and denied them. And that is a sustained act of demagoguery by an entire party. It is Donald Trump, who just mouths off, is nothing, is a piker by comparison with Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker and Chuck Schumer when he's at his worst. I actually think Chuck Schumer knows better and in some ways tries to do better. What's interesting to me is Donald Trump is a piker by comparison with many of the Democrats right now.
John Gabriel, do you think that there's a chance that the at some point they will realize on the Democratic side that constantly harping on racism and structural inequality as the reason for the school's bad performance is just not going to resonate all over the place? It's a very specifically ideologically tailored message.
I think I've actually talked to a few Democratic strategists who do understand that, but they are the voices in the wilderness. I think right now the problem with living in a bubble, and I'm of the belief that there isn't only this liberal Acela corridor bubble. We all have our own bubbles, and you need to force yourself out of them and talk to people around. It's much easier being a conservative in a liberal area and vice versa. But they seem to want to go to their old playbook of trying to impress the media in D.C. and New York, and they need to stop that. I heard a lot of people after Manchin, I believe, supported DeVos saying, we need to primary him. All these calls on Twitter, especially Facebook. Oh, we need to primary Manchin. We can't have this, you know, crazy bigot, horrible person representing our party. And it's like, okay, why don't you move to West Virginia for a while and figure out what's going on the ground and see the situation that he's in. He has one foot out the door of the Democratic Party as it is. That's right. Might want to recalibrate your thoughts. You're not going to run Nancy Pelosi in West Virginia. It doesn't work. And instead of just appealing to the coasts, they might want to spend some time in the heartland. And there are some good Democrats out there doing it. I think someone like Schumer, as was said, does know better. He understands the map. He saw that sea of red between these little redoubts on each coast. It's kind of in a bind. He has protesters showing up at his house now, screaming and chanting and waving signs. I think they're still a little bit shell-shocked. They created this community-organized monster. And as usual, as always happens on the left, it's turning on them. They might want to be reading about the histories of the French Revolution to see if there's an elegant way out of this. But the leftist revolutionary yesterday is now considered a crazy right-wing extremist the next day. And that's where the Democrats in the Senate and House find themselves.
Yeah, slap some animal fat on the axles of those tumbrils, because it's time to march the old guard to the guillotine. Yeah, it's fun. I don't think we're going to be heading to the terror that quickly, but we'll see. Now, you're right. The revolutionaries always eat their own. You know, learning history is a good thing. And sometimes you just want to say to people, would you come over here and look at this screen that I got up? It's got this place called the Great Courses, and you can learn things here about history, which, oddly enough, did not begin in 1963 or 1991 or 2008. Now it goes back quite a while, as a matter of fact, and you might learn something. It's so satisfying to learn something new, you know, whether it's a topic that already interests you or an entirely new subject. And that's why we love telling you about the Great Courses Plus. We want you to discover the Great Courses Plus, too. So they're offering you, the Ricochet listener, a full free month when you sign up using our special URL, or URL, as we like to say, thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. What'll you find there? You will find video lectures. How many? 8,000 or more. And they add new ones all the time. You can explore topics that interest you or look at things like, I don't know, history, politics, business, even cooking and photography. I mean, they're video courses, so you can learn things visually as well as what you listen to. And they're all presented by award-winning experts. Recently, they put up something of note: Outsmart Yourself, Brain-Based Strategies to a Better You. It's an interesting and sometimes rather counterintuitive, frankly, series of insights from a neurosurgeon who looks at how to boost your well-being. Davis suggests that the more that people tell you about a long-term goal, the less likely you are to achieve it. What? Is that? You'll have to read the lecture, listen to it, and find out. Or wander off into another corridor and learn something about something you never thought you even wanted to. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. One full month free. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com. I'm sorry, thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. And we thank them for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Now let's talk some law. Who wants some law around here? I want some law, and you want...
I want some law.
When you want law, you go for your U. And that's why we've got John back. He's the Emmanuel S. Heller.
Hello.
Hello, John. John, I was in the process of giving you a warm introduction, but, you know, you just barged right in and just interrupted me doing the Rob thing. So I'm stepping back here and saying, hey, let's talk about that Ninth Circuit ruling. Is it going to stand? Is it good? What's bad? What happened?
First, I think it'll stand. I can't see the Ninth Circuit as a whole stepping in to overrule this case. And I don't see why the Supreme Court would want to, at this time, with one of the nominees to its own court, Neil Gorsuch, up for confirmation for the Senate, would want to wade into this political and constitutional mess. You know, that said,
John, how does can you just tell us, decide which cases to hear? It has discretion in every single instance, doesn't it? There are no cases it must hear. Just explain that if you would.
Oh, sure. The Supreme Court has what's called the writ of certiorari, which allows it to pick which cases to hear. It has a almost completely discretionary jurisdiction, except for a few kinds of cases like voting rights, which Congress requires it to take. But 99, it only picks. It only has two bases to do it. One is questions of great national importance, which, you know, arguably this case falls into. Or the second one, which this case will ultimately fall into, is cases where federal courts across the country are in conflict and have issued decisions that don't agree with each other.
But the Supreme Court doesn't have to justify itself to anybody. And in fact, it doesn't even have to display its real reasoning. If they all say, in effect, about this case, well, you know, this is politically inflammatory, and when it comes right down to it, we're just too chicken to be involved. If that's essentially their real reasoning, they get to turn it down, and the Ninth Circuit, the panel of the Ninth Circuit, prevails, right? Is if I got it right? I'm just trying to figure out when Donald Trump tweets in capital letters, as he did early this morning, "See you in court." It's not up to him.
Peter, I got to say, if you went to law school, you'd get the first A of your life in school, because that's exactly 100% correct.
Okay.
It's exactly right. The Supreme Court, when it turns down the thousands of cases that get appealed to it, it gives usually no reason. It could even just decide this isn't the right time and we'd like to hear it next year or in 2 years. It doesn't have to. There's no grounds that anyone has a right to go to the court. And the meaning of it for the Trump order is, as you set out, that if the court doesn't take the case, that means the lower court's ruling stays in place because the Supreme Court didn't intervene to overturn you. So the Ninth Circuit ban, which is really, you know, just upholding a district court's temporary restraining order, would stay in effect, and the Trump travel ban would stay suspended.
And now, as to the rightness of the legal reasoning, if you had been a member of the three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit, would you also have voted to let the injunction? I'm getting my legal term. If you would you also have voted as they voted?
This is a really hard case, and it's much harder than I think the Ninth Circuit or the district judge allowed. There's two conflicting provisions here, which you wouldn't even know about if you read the cases. One says that the president and the government shall not administer the immigration laws in a way that discriminates based on race or gender or, here, national origin. However, there's another provision in the immigration laws that says the president can suspend immigration from – and it calls it quote-unquote class of aliens, which it doesn't define, if the president believes it's in the national interest. And so you can see Trump has the authority under that statute to suspend aliens coming from any country. However, he can't do it in a way that discriminates. And so those provisions are in conflict. I think as an appeals court, I completely understand. And this would have been the better thing to do if you're the appeals court than I think to go to more of the substance. Because notice this case is not really about the merits about this issue. It's just about, can there be a temporary halt to the order so that there's time to have a full argument and briefing and full consideration of these legal and constitutional questions. Usually appellate courts are very reluctant to overturn a trial judge who issues a temporary restraining order.
Right. John, I have one more question, if you'll indulge me before James and John Gabriel get in. And that is this, the constitutional question. We've heard over and over again that the Constitution says the president may not impose a religious test. Now, set aside for a moment the administration's claim, which I myself find compelling, that since the ban, the temporary ban, only applies to Muslim majority countries that account for about 12% of the worldwide Muslim population, Indonesia, country of 400 million, is not affected by this ban. But therefore it's not a Muslim ban. But set that aside. Suppose it is a Muslim ban. Does the Constitution bind us in the way we must treat non-citizens? I always thought the Constitution bound the government in its treatment of Americans. Am I just plain wrong on that?
No, no. This also is really complicated. And I think for once in all of our lives together, Peter, I think I'm a little bit to the left of you, slightly, maybe on this question.
This is a first for me.
I feel very uncomfortable here. I feel unprotected and weak being to the left of you. But
I mean, believe me, there's no safe space over at Berkeley for you, baby.
I'm gonna go outside, put on black, and burn myself in effigy now.
Okay, no, but go ahead and explain. Yeah, I don't understand any of the commentary on the constitutional point.
The constitutional question is actually interesting and close. Part of it has to do with, is there any right here at all? And then the second equally important question, does anyone have the ability to enforce it? So suppose it is a Muslim ban. I think I agree with something you said there, which is, Peter, non-citizens outside the United States have no constitutional rights. I think actually that's a point of the opinion the Ninth Circuit issued that's quite wrong because they suggest otherwise. So, you know, every Muslim in the world doesn't have a right to enter the United States. You know, every Muslim in the world doesn't – we don't owe the right to free exercise of religion to every Muslim in the world, only the ones who are connected to our country, the citizens, permanent resident aliens, or people on our territory. So – but there's another religion clause in the Constitution that's more centrally involved. And that's what we call the Establishment Clause. And that forbids – essentially it says it's not the separation of church and state that everyone thinks. That's just Jefferson made that up about the Constitution. It's really – it basically forbids the government from establishing a state church or trying to favor one religion over another. As you can see, that might be a problem. You know, could the government save the country? That I think runs into the Establishment Clause. The problem is, as you pointed out – if non-citizens don't have rights, it's not clear how that provision gets enforced in a judicial opinion. And so if you read the Ninth Circuit, that's what really stretched, I think, quite hard was to try to say people outside the United States have a right. Now, I got to say the Trump White House really screwed up, and this order could, I think, easily have been legal if they had just taken a little more care with it, because the order applies to green card holders, and the courts have long said green card holders have rights. They live here. They're on our territory. And the Ninth Circuit really hammered and made that the crux of its decision to reject the order at this temporary stage, because they said it applies to green card holders. You can't say they are immune from judicial review. You can't say the government can do whatever they want to them. They may have the right to come back into the country and protest a ban just on Muslims.
John Gabriel is about to ask you about the nomination of Judge Gorsuch, but I just want to close this out. Am I correct, John, that the administration's fundamental stance toward this ban on immigrants, temporary ban on immigrants to review our immigration procedures and so forth, is fundamentally lawful? Whether you think it's wise or not, it's fundamentally lawful, and the administration – through sheer rashness, through frankly not quite knowing what they were doing, rushed out an executive order, failed even to anticipate the legal challenges, it seems to me, and then put this career guy at Justice in to argue before the panel, the Ninth Circuit panel, who didn't seem – it felt to me, listening to the excerpts I heard on the news, that he didn't really have his heart in it and hadn't been fully – that you get this feeling – they could have done what they wanted to do if they'd known what they were doing. Is that fair?
Yes, Peter. I think that's right. That if the government can restrict immigration from different nations. In fact, before the 1965 reforms to the immigration laws, that's the only way the United States used to allocate immigration slots. So there's nothing illegal or unconstitutional about choosing to have more immigration from individual nations. But as you say, this Trump White House, this was amateur hour, I hate to say. And I think they rushed it out too fast, and they were looking for political impact. They wanted to shock and awe, which I can see making sense in a political campaign, but that's no way to run a government.
John, this is John Gabriel.
Hello.
And welcome to the show. I really appreciated listening to your explanations on your excellent podcast, Law Talk, and trying to wade through all the vagaries of the law on this issue and seeing how little precedent there is. There's been a lot of histrionics. We were talking earlier about, oh my gosh, Trump's election, the dark night of fascism is descending. When we see these court orders, it's like, oh yeah, separation of powers. I think that gave some people a little bit of pause. But I'm wondering about Judge Gorsuch. It seems like, Trump has criticized several judges now, and people are very disturbed about the separation of powers when he does that. But it seems like if he wanted someone to endorse a far stronger executive than we've ever seen in this country, Gorsuch is precisely the wrong pick for him to make.
Yeah. So, first, thanks for your comments about the Law Talk podcast, although the law and explaining its intricacies are no challenge compared to just getting a word edgewise in on Richard Epstein.
he should learn to breathe every once in a while before paragraphs.
I need to get a pay increase from zero to zero plus one. The guys are paying me to keep that man in line. But I'm concerned about the separation of powers, and I have some concerns, strong concerns about how Trump is using presidential power. But one area I don't is criticizing the courts. I think presidents have long criticized the courts, and much more sharply than Trump has so far. We shouldn't forget President Obama attacking the Supreme Court to its face during the State of the Union address over Citizens United, or Mau Mauing John Roberts, trying to get him to switch his vote, which he successfully did in the first challenge to the Obamacare case. The heavens didn't fall. The liberal media found no problems with President Obama attacking the court. The second thing about executive power and Judge Gorsuch, I feel bad for Judge Gorsuch. I mean, if this is like a nightmare for his confirmation, is having a president saying, oh, judges are all political. Oh, but please confirm this guy who I'm sending to the Supreme Court. he's in a hard position. And, we saw those reports of him saying that he's demoralized and that the Trump comments about the courts have been discouraging. On the other hand, as you suggest, of the people that Trump could have picked from on that list of 21 judges he put out during the campaign – that he would pick from for the Supreme Court. Gorsuch is probably more on the, I wouldn't say anti-executive side, but he's less of a devotee to presidential power than many others on that list. And the reason why I say that is because he wrote, his probably most important opinion he wrote as a lower court judge was calling for an end to judicial deference to the regulatory state and the president's decisions overseeing the administration. He thinks that when the law is unclear and judges accept the views of administrative agencies, he thinks that ought to come to an end, and judges should review all those questions based only on their own judgment. That would be a great restriction, a huge cutback in presidential power, should he get on the court and be able to convince his fellow justices to adopt his view.
Right, and we've also seen lots of comparisons of Gorsuch to Scalia. And I know that's kind of shorthand in the media for people who don't watch the courts, just saying, oh, he's conservative, conservative saying, oh, he's on our side. What are the differences between he and Scalia? Because those seem rather significant as well.
Yes, I think, in temperament, actually, Gorsuch is a nicer guy than Scalia. I mean, Scalia loved nothing more than to get into a brawl. In some ways, Scalia was almost like the judicial version of Donald Trump. He loved to be the bull breaking up the china in the shop. Gorsuch is a much more he might have the same view on how to interpret the Constitution. That's where they're very similar. But Gorsuch is not going to pick fights. You can tell from his opinions he's a consensus builder. He's not going to attack other justices as Scalia did for engaging in jiggery pokery. I mean, I love Scalia's lines, though, but he's not going to – that's not Gorsuch. On the other hand, Gorsuch's substantive views are really a rejection of the Scalia-Bork approach to the role of the courts and the Constitution. Scalia and Bork were what we call positivists. They thought the only thing they should enforce was in the written text – of the Constitution. There were no unenumerated individual rights. The big problem is judicial discretion and power and how to restrain the judges. Gorsuch is the opposite. Gorsuch does – just we were just discussing. Gorsuch thinks judges should review afresh every decision by the administrative agencies. The other thing he thinks is that natural right and natural law ought to be central. Gorsuch wrote this book attacking assisted suicide and euthanasia, and his basic approach was that because there's natural rights, and we haven't really – I mean Justice Clarence Thomas is the closest thing we have to that, but he hasn't really used that as a basis to ever strike down a federal law. That really hasn't been present on our court, using natural law, natural rights to block federal law since the early 1930s.
I heard the intake of breath that suggests Peter Robinson had one more question. Am I right, Peter? Or
No, I don't have one more question. I have hours worth of questions. I find this is all fascinating, and John has this amazing ability. I don't know why I should flatter him when he's to the left of me this morning. I don't know. Yeah. But John has this amazing – he has mastered it all. It's all extremely intricate. It's all very complicated, and yet in the hands of John Yoo, constitutional law becomes accessible to laymen. It is just an amazing gift.
But well, we look forward to Elizabeth Warren announcing you're going to be her running mate in 2020.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
You know what? She's all this big talk, but she was only a bankruptcy law professor, you know. She, you know, in the hierarchy of professorship, she's way down there. I mean, I don't know where she gets off talking about the Constitution now.
You almost make it sound as if there is some sort of hierarchy within law and academia that values or devalues people by what they choose to study. It's impossible. We all know it's an egalitarian paradise of mutual admiration. Right. Thank you, John. We'll talk to you during the next constitutional crisis, which I think is scheduled for 2:57 this afternoon.
Thanks, guys.
See you later.
John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
John, you. And John Oliver. Not John Gabriel. We've been to him. We're going to get back to him. But in the middle of all these Johns, we're going to give you John Oliver. Who's that? Well, you know who that guy is. He's that guy, the HBO Emmy-winning series. Last Week Tonight is the name of John's show. Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. And it presents a satirical look at the week in news, politics, and current events, as well as addressing broader issues. The show is the only weekly news-oriented comedy series presented on Sunday nights. And executive produced by John Oliver, the fourth season of Last Week Tonight premieres Sunday, February 12th at 11 p.m., only on HBO. And now, because we want to take everything down a little bit, because we want to just get real mellow and relaxed and just sort of toss the conversational ball back and forth, not really standing for anything or meaning anything or just kind of relaxing in a warm, salty bath of agreement.
It's time for Mamby Pamby.
That's exactly right. Time for somebody who's afraid to say what he says, terrified of staking out a position, and spends all of his time on Twitter saying, "I'm sorry." Oh, that's a lie. We welcome back to the show our friend David Limbaugh. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Jesus on Trial, A Lawyer Affirms the Truth of the Gospel. And we call him the L. Rush Bro for reasons that are obvious. You can follow him on Twitter and do so at David Limbaugh. Lots of fun. Welcome back, David. How do you like your president so far?
I like most things about him. I'm pretty pumped up about what's going on.
Hey, pumped up and fired up, though, because this has been a week of controversy. Of course, they're all kind of going to be weeks of controversy.
That's a fact. Prepared to dissect those as you guys wish. But I'm feeling pretty good about it. The left is crazy. I'm glad Trump is fighting back. They're largely fighting him based on lies and perceptions rather than what he's actually doing. It's like it's a status crime. Lawyers understand. You're just guilty by virtue of who you are, not anything you've done, which, of course, is unconstitutional. And this is just an analogy. It's not an actual crime. But people are judging Trump. The left's going nuts. They're protesting everywhere about nothing and because of who Trump is or who supports him. So they need to be countered. And to the extent that Trump is unorthodox and the only one that's likely to counter them on their own terms, I'm all for it. He may not be as presidential as some people would like. But maybe we don't need somebody that's presidential when we got a crazy opposition like we have right now.
David,
but maybe there's a point, and hold on, Peter.
No,
Peter,
go ahead.
I'm going to hand it to you in a second here.
Go ahead.
I just want to ask, is there a point, and you know that there is, where the fact that the left is angry about something doesn't mean that the right is right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, are you saying that we, just because the left takes a position and is wrong about it, we shouldn't resist the position, or we shouldn't be intellectually dishonest just to fight them? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, because, and I'm not saying it's happened yet, I just find myself all the time saying, I'm a little too happy about how miserable some of these people are, and I don't want that to become my metric for judging whether or not a policy is the right idea.
That's a very good point. I approach it from a different perspective. I'm not happy that they're miserable. I'm outraged that they've worked themselves up into being miserable. And I will confess something. And it happened during the Bush thing. I'm kind of a team player. I'm an adversary. I'm a fighter. And I view this as a war, an outright war for the future of the country. And so when the left went after George W. Bush and lied, I might go soft on my criticism of him on certain domestic policies because I didn't want to pile on, because to add to the criticism would just further embolden the left. Now, there's a fine line then. I don't want to be intellectually dishonest. I'm just saying in terms of what I emphasize. And so here we have Trump, and he does some things that I wouldn't do, that I opposed during the primaries. And it's not the way I would prefer to have certain things approached, such as his tweets. But on the other hand, I'm not going to pile on against him. First place, we know Trump was elected with people knowing he was brash and spontaneous on his tweets, and he doesn't act what is traditionally considered presidential on those. And I'm also softening to the idea. It doesn't bother me. It's not that I don't care about somebody being presidential, but Obama was presidential. He had the crease in his pants. He was presidential all day long, sophisticated, mellifluous voice, while he destroyed the country. So where are my priorities? Trump, because of the nature of this opposition, I think it's acceptable that he's a little bit unorthodox in the way he goes after him. And Ivanka, people are all upset that Trump defended her in his role as president. He should do that as a dad. Well, that's just not Trump, and I don't care. I'm energized by a guy defending his daughter. The left blurs all kinds of lines from all that they don't respect the separation of powers, the judiciary's proper role, and here we are always required to play by the Marcus of Queensberry rules, and it gets a little old, and it's refreshing to fight back. Again, I'm not defending anything we might do that's wrong or improper. I'm not advocating conservative ignoring of the rule of law. I'd want to do all that, but some little activities by Trump where he acts less than presidential do not upset me, and sometimes they kind of energize me.
Peter here. Time for me. May I come in?
Sorry.
No.
Absolutely.
No, I just wanted to make you. So let me ask you this question, David, sort of a baseline question. Should he tweet, or would you be happier if he just quit the tweeting? I ask you this of a man who tweets all day long himself, and I know that because whenever my attention flags in my own work, I'm off reading your tweets, David. I confess that.
Well, I've been very, very sporadic about my own tweeting for a while, but now I'm back a little bit, but I'm not going to ever get back as much as I was. It's an addiction like anything else, but I feel like I'm going to be more powerful and less voluminous to the extent that I can when I tweet. But
well,
yes.
Do you wish the president of the United States would follow that formula?
Yes, but I'm conflicted on this too. And
really?
That is to say, I wish he wouldn't divert and give them ammunition by some of his impertinent tweets. On the other hand, I kind of like that he has no – because the media shuts him down – and they always report his tweets. At least that's a way for him to get his position out there, and it definitely gets out there. I wish he would. There would be a way. It's almost impossible. With Trump, you take the good with the bad, and the fact that he goes after them is what is so refreshing, and he does it a little bit over the top, makes it refreshing, but it also makes it problematic. I wish there was a way to balance that, but once you start trying to rein somebody in like that and make a more make them exercise more restraint, you kind of take the guts out of what they're doing. So it's a little bit of a tricky proposition, in my opinion.
Okay, so here another question. I'm just trying to calibrate where you stand on Trump and the administration, because you have, as usual, once you talk to David, you discover that your views are actually a little more complicated. I thought you'd be full on for Trump. And in fact,
I am.
Well,
totally.
But you'd wish he wouldn't do this and you wish he wouldn't do that. So here's a question. We just had quite a long conversation with John Yoo about the immigration temporary ban and the way the courts had handled it. And John Yoo made the point that if the administration had exercised a little more care and gone a little more slowly, that is to the extent of a couple of days, that the order would most likely have been able to accomplish 90% of what they wanted it to accomplish, and it would have withstood legal scrutiny. Okay. If they had just slowed down and been a little more professional. And so the question here is, Donald Trump has never held government office. He's surrounded by people. He got his White House staff in with him immediately. The cabinet, the seasoned cabinet figures, are only just now showing up. They're only just now being confirmed. Are you hoping that the administration, how to put this, learns the ropes, becomes more effective? Or the counterargument to that would be, look, learning the ropes is just another way for saying being co-opted by official Washington. How do you feel about that?
I think you framed the question beautifully, and that's exactly the dilemma I'm describing. But I do think there's a balance. I think you can be brash. I think you can be forceful and still come within the boundaries of the law. But see, I'd reject the premise that you and Epstein are talking about. The Ninth Circuit, it wouldn't have mattered what Trump did. The Ninth Circuit didn't base their decision, nor did the district judge base their decisions on the law at all. That is patently clear. Therefore, it wouldn't have mattered how circumspect he was in the order. And I don't think the order was illegal. I think he has plenary power. But let's say it was inartfully done because he didn't have all of his cabinet in place. That's a legitimate criticism. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, he's following up on his campaign promises. He made an effort. They're rejecting it. I think it was Ken Cuccinelli made a suggestion that he let this order go and that he issue a series of discrete orders that would keep him busy and that would be effective, and he could effectuate exactly what he wanted to effectuate. So here's Siri's talking back to me. Sorry, Siri, I totally turned you off. What a witch she is. But what I'm saying is, I guess I don't agree. The Ninth Circuit and the left is going to politicize everything. So what difference does it make if we go through these hoops just to be rebuffed anyway illegally by them? Yes, I would like to do it right to the extent we can. But in his defense, he didn't have everybody in place. He should have vetted it better, but that's easy for me to say.
Okay, last question from me before we go back to James, and John Gabriel's on the line. I know John wants to talk to you as well, David. Here's the last question from me. Yesterday or the day before, this very week, Senator Cotton of Arkansas introduced legislation that would cut legal immigration in half. I'm not saying that would build the wall. I'm not saying that would crack down on people who are here on overstaying their visas, and I'm not saying deporting felons who are here illegally. All of that is a separate matter. This is legislation that would cut legal immigration in half, and it would change the kinds of people who immigrate into people who would – it's complicated, and I have to say I haven't read the legislation, but the general idea seems to be you don't get to come here because you have family members. You only get to come here if, for in one way or another, against certain criteria, your being here would be good for the United States. Not a question of whether it would be good for the immigrant, whether it would be good for the United States. Here's the question. And by the way, I haven't heard him denounced by his fellow Republicans at all. In fact, there seems to be a position. It wouldn't surprise me if the Republican caucus got behind that and got behind it quickly. Question runs as follows. Would any member of the Senate ever have thought about introducing any such legislation if Donald Trump, if there had only been 16 candidates for the Republican nomination and the 17th, Donald Trump had stayed home in New York?
A brilliant.
Did Donald Trump win on immigration in a way that only he could?
I think that's a brilliant rhetorical question that answers itself, and I agree that that's true. That some of these senators, some of the Republicans, are emboldened because of the mandate and because of the nature of Trump. I don't know. I haven't seen that legislation either, and I haven't even considered the merits of it. But I do believe, I subscribe to the notion that this is about American sovereignty, and we have a right to accept or reject people we want from foreign countries or don't want. And we don't have to answer to anyone on that except ourselves. And so the laws that we enact in that should reflect, of course, our values. But I think I hate the left always saying that because their values aren't our values. And the values that I want to promote are the American idea. And that means a unique American culture. And that means patriotism and people who will learn and respect the Constitution and rule of law, which is what the naturalization process was designed to do. That's why you have this orderly legal immigration process. Whether you reduce it, it's another issue, but it's worth considering because we've got – we're our entire culture, our entire nation, the American idea is under assault, and I think we should do whatever we have to do constitutionally to preserve it.
Hi, David. This is John Gabriel, and you talked earlier about Trump being – quite unorthodox, but I think what's being missed is how unorthodox the left has become. On Friday morning, you had Betsy DeVos trying to visit an elementary school in D.C., and she was blocked by a mob of protesters screaming shame, shame at her, and she had to cancel the visit. So these are the people who, of course, care about the children. What do you think about just the left's histrionic, hysterical, insane, add the adjective of your choice there, their reaction to him? And not only their reaction, how do you respond to that, but how does this help them or can it?
Well, they further expose themselves for the extremists they are. This is what I was alluding to before. They are literally bonkers. Now, I tweeted the other day that it doesn't matter who would have won the presidency, if the Republican won, if Cruz or anyone else, the left would be just as bonkers. Now, yes, that was hyperbole. But my point is, Trump is a convenient scapegoat for them. These people lost, and they lost their power. They're crybabies. They can't stand a process when it works against them. They're in justifies the means people. They're fair weather constitutionalists and Democrats, lowercase d. And they are demonstrating their unreasonableness, their irrationality, their outrageousness. The argument that they have a right to commit violence in a Milo Yiannopoulos appearance, under the pretense that they're going, that Milo might, with his speech, incite violence. So they commit violence to prevent possible violence, and it's. There's nothing rational about the left. There's nothing fair about the left. I saw that about DeVos the other day. They're doing all kinds of stuff. A university is sponsoring a workshop, an anti-Trump workshop. That's with public money we're talking about. Six New England Patriots now have announced that they're not going to go to the White House meeting. See, all of this goes back to what I said before. Trump is a villain and evil, and he's a racist because the left says he is. But he's not. He's not a racist. He's an immigration hawk. As much as I was against Trump for certain things he did during the primary, that was not one of them. He's not a nativist. Yes, you might have some fringe supporters of Trump who misbehave and who could be accused of that, but that's not Trump. Trump is not that way. He's not a sexist. Despite some of the things he's done, he respects women in terms of the workplace and all that, and I don't want to get in an argument with that because I'm not going to defend some of the things he's done. But my point is they are all working themselves up into a frenzy over a fiction that Trump might do some things that they have a right to complain about, but he hasn't done anything yet other than this order. They were ready. They were on point, ready to protest. They couldn't wait till he did something to give them some excuse. And now they're going nuts, and they're going to continue to go nuts the next 4 years. And we have to fight them with fire.
And by the way, this supposed fascist Donald Trump has been ordered by the courts to do one thing. And that is to withdraw the immigration ban, at least pending a final decision by the Supreme Court. And he has complied. There's absolutely the idea that he's – anyway, all right, sorry. You're much more eloquently enraged than I am, David. So
I just
add that little addendum.
Well, the fun is – John, are you the one that is responsible for drafting that daily shot every day?
I am the mere editor.
It's really good. I just want to compliment you guys, Ricochet. Thank you. It's a very good email, which for, I want your subscribers, podcast listeners to know. It is a great way, if you have that on email, to get a sampling of what the news is out there. It's a good little summary every morning. I'm telling you that, Peter. What do you think, Peter?
Fred Cole is the writer, and he is doing a fantastic job.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Yeah, there you go. See?
Well, there's a nice plug. There's a great plug, and it's not as if it's going to be lacking for material in the months to come, because this is going to go on and on and on and on. David, what you talked about your idea of American particularism, exceptionalism, nationalism, patriotism, and all those things are in stark and irreconcilable contrast to the people who believe that you should just be able to be a citizen simply by getting here, entitled to a bunch of things, and nothing is required of you. These are not issues that can be hammered out in committee. And it seems as if we're going to spend the next few years actually having the arguments and the fights that we've been wanting to have for 20 years, in which finally there's going to be a victory of one side or the other, because these ideas cannot coexist. One of them has to yield.
Exactly, which is why we always say the left is lying when they promote bipartisanship, which means agree with us, do roll over and do it. We shouldn't even pretend to be bipartisan. This is a war. We need to defeat them. I mean fairly and squarely, civilly and all that, but we need to defeat them. The other thing I want to say is an example of their propaganda and Orwellian speak. When they say that immigration hawks are nativists, I can't speak for every immigration hawk, but what I said a minute ago, we want to preserve and promote and perpetuate the American idea. Now, that by its very nature is not ethnically based or racially based. I don't care what anyone looks like, what their skin color is, what their gender is. America was an amalgam. America was a melting pot. We forget the melting part of it. We want to merge into one unique American idea, no matter what we look like. What the left wants is everybody to be segregated into these separate identities and to think alike. It's the opposite of the American idea, but it is the opposite of racism to promote the American idea, which eschews racism. So I'm sick of rolling over to this idea that the left has that we're all racist. And a lot of these young kids who come from conservative families are buying into this stuff. I've seen it in my personal life, not my family, thank goodness, but some of my close friends, kids go away to college and buy into this evil tripe that the liberals promote, such as the Palestinians are the wonderful people and the Israelis are the aggressors. I mean, this is toxic stuff going on in our culture and on our campuses. And we have to realize in academia, we have to fight. We really have to fight. And that's what bothers me about the Republican establishment, so-called Republican establishment. I feel good about how they're backing Trump, but I don't want them to fall into this civility thing if that means they've got to be pretend and go softly and not fight fire with fire. We have to fight fire with fire, and you can't ever let down. The left is relentless. Every day they're fighting and they're trying to change the country and trying to demonize us and what we stand for. We've got to fight every day. We can't let up one breath.
Well, I'm Mr. Civility, which makes me a rhino squish because Rob isn't here, so somebody has to be. David, as always, a great pleasure, and we'll talk to you and see you on Twitter.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
David, thanks, David.
Sorry for hyperventilating, although it was fun.
We understand. Now we're going to do this. Now we're going to do the same. Actually, no, it's impossible to. We're going to wind things down here. But I have to note a couple of things. One, David mentioned about the Israelis versus the Palestinians, that one side is virtuous and the other side are the colonialist oppressors, the rest of it. There was a tweet the other day from somebody that said, punch a Zionist today. And it was interesting because it's okay to punch people now, right? I mean, since everybody agreed that it was good to punch a Nazi, then Nazi became very broadly defined and punching was okay. And then this kid said, punch a Zionist today. And I looked at that and it's from some guy who runs a BDS club at some school in Canada. And he's had to retract and apologize and explain what he means. But people looked at that and, as people always do, say, well, then boycott Canada. But you ask yourself, what does Canada make exactly besides maple syrup that we like? What would be a sacrifice in boycotting something from Canada? Do they have wines? Do they make wines in Canada? I don't know. But frankly, if I wanted to find out, I'd join Wink. And so should you. It's spelled W-I-N-K. And we will learn about Canadian wines at some point down the road, I guess, because they have access to everything. Here's what it is. Now, if you like good wine, but you can't spell, as I said before, sommelier, which means possibly you're not Canadian because they have that whole dual language thing going, it's time to take the stress out of wine shopping and try Wink. It's the new way to get all of the best wines perfectly matched to your palate. You know how you go to the store sometimes and you just don't know? This one's jammy. This one's got tannins. What is it? This one's got a great label. You don't know what to decide. Well, Wink, spelled W-I-N-C, by the way, works directly with winemakers and growers from all over the world to create delicious wines and deliver them right to your door. 100% satisfaction guarantee means if you don't like the bottle they send you, they'll replace it with a bottle you'll love. No questions asked. Now, you don't just get random bottles. It's not like they're buying a bunch of stuff and fobbing it off on you. Wink is a personalized wine membership that recommends wine specifically for you based on a palate profile quiz. I've taken it. It's fun. You can also rate the wines you receive from Wink so they learn more about your taste with every order and constantly personalize and perfect the wines they send to you. Now, sign up for Wink right now and gain immediate insider access to all the best fine wine from all over the world. Find out for yourself why the hosts of the Ricochet Podcast, yours truly and others, and thousands of other satisfied wine lovers are raving about Wink. The best part? Wink is offering Ricochet Podcasters listeners $20 off right now. When you go to trywink.com/ricochet, they'll even cover the shipping. That's trywink, trywinc.com/ricochet. Think of that. You get fine wine personalized to your palate, delivered right to your door. And there's also a great book that comes along with it that tells all the stories of the wine, and it's great reading while you sit and sip. $20 off and complimentary shipping right now when you go to trywink.com/ricochet. That's try, trywinc.com. Ricochet. And our thanks to Wink for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. And maybe we'll be buying bottles and bottles and bottles to share and celebrate the first Ricochet engagement. That's right. We have the first Rico engagement to announce. Congrats to Ricochet members 1967 Mustang Man and Vicryl Contessa, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Congrats. We raise a glass of Wink-supplied wine to you and hope your marriage will be, of course, center-right, civil, and well moderated. And, you know, really, we hope Rob shows up and gives you a toast or something like that, right?
Isn't that a wonderful, lovely, Ricochet is now producing weddings. Wonderful. Congratulations to them. I think that's just really cool.
We need a new membership above Reagan that.
That's right.
Maybe the Reagan.
Married.
Yeah. The Reagan and Nancy membership. We can that's have. It. And we will run an eHarmony type service for our members.
Well, one last topic to go out. Our friend EJ Hill, of course, the Photoshop guru master ninja who does the art for these podcasts and other things, posted about the press and the president's daughter. Did you guys, when you saw the whole Ivanka Nordstrom kerfluffle, did you also think of Truman and his daughter?
I did immediately. That was really was the first thing that came to mind. In fact, I wasn't sure. I remembered the famous letter that Truman sent to the music critic in the Washington Post who had savaged Margaret Truman when she sang, I can't remember where, in any event, I remembered the letter. It was very famous. And Truman had said, if I meet you, you'll need beefsteak for black eyes and maybe some support below. Okay. It was my memory, though, that Truman had just written that thing and filed it, that he never mailed it. So I went online to check that. And I was wrong. Truman actually did mail the letter. And you can find online the provenance of the letter. Hume kept it for years. The music critic kept the original for years. And it is now in the collection of a rich Texas oil man. It's changed hands a few times, but it is now quite a valuable historical artifact.
I'm going to punch you in the face and kick you in the groin. I mean, that's so we do have precedent then for
yes,
rough talking
we do.
When it comes. And also, there was talk of when the Ninth Circuit and all the reversals and the rest of it, people went back to Lincoln and say, this is what Lincoln said about some judges. And so there's precedent for that. Do you get the feeling that every single historical precedent in 200, X plus years of American history is going to be repeated somehow? That everything that every president did from Jackson to Woodrow Wilson is somehow going to be reflected because there's just so much
in about
on.
10 more days, Trump will run through them all.
Well, and if critics are blanching at Trump's use of Twitter, we can all be thankful that Twitter didn't exist when LBJ was president.
Yes, indeed, there would have been a he'd learned to use the photo function. That would have been interesting. Not safe for work picture coming in from the first man. Yeah, well, if they're blanching, it's because they've done this Roman style and emptied up a vein in a warm bath, and that's why they're looking a little white. Fun for all. And it's only been what? He's only been president for what? How many months now? How many months? One. Right. Okay. Well, nothing.
Months? No shortage. Only months? It feels like years. Right.
No. Well, you know, time moves faster as you age, but that doesn't mean that you can't scrabble for a handhold as you slide down the abyss. Grab something, pull yourself up, spend some time, learn something, figure out what justifies your existence on the right side of the dirt. And that's what the Great Courses is for, thegreatcoursesplus.com. Go there, sign up, full free month, learn something. And, of course, we thank you for listening. If you're in the Slate side, you're going to love the John Oliver Show, which premieres this weekend. And if you're not on the Slate side of things, you might want to see what they're talking about. It's instructive. John Oliver's fourth season premieres this weekend. And also we thank Wink, W-I-N-K, which provides great wine. Trust me, personal experience. Yes, great wine. And we thank all of you, of course, who belong to Ricochet and those of you who are thinking about it right now because he had so much fun. Go to the Ricochet store if you would. Get some R-branded merchandise that you can use. Why, at work, hand them a flash drive with the Ricochet logo. They'll say, "What's this?" And you can tell them, and they'll be stunned that such a place exists. If you enjoyed the show, why don't you wander on over to iTunes and give us a review, an honest one, of course. It'll help new listeners discover us, which always helps the show going and hence the site itself. Be one of the 500. Join if you haven't. And that means you can go to the member feed and say things and cavort and romp with everybody else in the Elysian fields of the center right. John, it's been a pleasure. Peter, as always, we thank our guests, and we'll see everybody in the comments at Ricochet 3.0.
Next week, fellas.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Join the conversation.
Someone do popsicles, someone do something magic. Cause it's late in October, a tar still melting the street. You tiptoe for ages, but lose yourself. Flipping back pages, unbuckling belts.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.